massive load number. Your particular solar cell today maybe give you maximum energy output if you put 125 ohm load on it. And tomorrow maybe the ideal resistor is a 135 ohm load resistor on a brighter sunny day. Gives you the maximum energy output. So you're creating a load resistance. Electronically, you're creating a load resistance. You're not biasing it with a power supply. Yes, you're trying to make a circuit, a switching regulator, that presents a particular equivalent resistor, which in turn, at the voltage being supplied by the solar cells, will draw a particular amount of current. So that voltage-current combination of load resistor gives you the maximum energy on today's solar illumination. So you're not doing that with a power supply. You're building an electronically variable load resistor. You're dithering that resistor. You're measuring the voltage and current at each one of those dither points. You're calculating the energy output in watts per second, you're calculating the energy output in watts, joules per second, watts, and you're setting that resistor constantly at that number that gives you the maximum energy today. So you're not feeding it with a power supply. Over to you, John, KQRIW.
Now, I realize that the power supply is the solar cell arrangement itself. All we're doing is regulating the voltage to try to keep it at the new point, which is our most efficient point, and the load would not change. You know, the load would be basically the same, so I think it would keep you in a ballpark anyway, and it would be very simple to do.
You said the load will not change. I'm saying the load will change between morning, noon, and night on Monday, and morning, noon, and night on Tuesday. You're going to get six different equivalent load resistors that give you the maximum energy during that period of time on that particular day. Over to you, John, K2IW.
Okay, we're both talking about the same thing in a circle, really. What I'm talking about is if we had a 10-watt bulb, that's a constant load. It's not going to draw any more or any less depending on the voltage that's fed to it. And if we monitored the voltage output of that power supply and used a control circuit to try to keep it close to the knee, I think that would be very easy to do, and it should keep the bulb happy.
It's funny that you chose a light bulb, John. A light bulb is one of the most variable resistors in the world. That light bulb, a 100-watt incandescent light bulb, draws 1,200 watts when you first turn it on. When it's cold, it has one-tenth or one-twelfth the amount of resistance. And when it gets hot, the resistance goes up real fast. So a light bulb makes a beautiful variable resistor for a feedback network on an oscillator. That's how the Hewlett-Packard Model 200 Wien Bridge Oscillator works. The feedback limiting resistor is a light bulb in the cathode of the tube that was doing the oscillating. So to try to use a light bulb as a load resistor on a set of solar cells, 99% of the time it would not be the optimum number, no matter what light bulb you used. Over to you, John, KQLIW.
Well, the light bulb would be the load and it would stay lit. So I think during the slight variations of the sun, you may see some dimming off and on, but if you kept that knee at the most efficient location, you know, within a parameter, I think it would work.
In the example I used, John, where this particular solar cell is producing 14.5 volts open circuit, at the knee is producing 12.5 volts at 100 milliamps, and you try drawing 120 milliamps, the voltage will drop down to zero. Because a light bulb has this crazy characteristic where when it's cold, it has one-twelfth of the normal resistance, you could have a light bulb on your solar cells, and if you started off with the light bulb lit and instantaneously connected it to the solar cells, it might be hunky-dory. But if the light bulb was unlit and you connected it to your solar cells, before the filament gets hot, where it's got one-twelfth of resistance, that light bulb in my example is trying to draw 150 milliamps. You try drawing 150 milliamps from the solar cells the voltage is zero. As such, that particular light bulb that's going to give you maximum efficiency when the light bulb is finally lit will never start up. It'll sit there, the solar cells will think there's a short circuit, it'll never produce more than a couple of million volts, the light bulb will never get hot, it'll never get up to the knee, if you know what I mean. So a light bulb on a set of solar cells could get you into a crazy condition where some days it lights and some days it doesn't light, and you think you've got an intermittent. Over to you, John, KQRIW.
Very good. Well, it's easy enough to put together. I got enough of that stuff to try it out, but just thought that would be an easier way to do it. But there's a couple of different ways you could, and I was just trying to think of something very simple. But at least you've answered his question that you don't think a short, being that it's only a 15% efficiency factor, he might not be damaging the cell at all. I think that's what he's worried about, but very good.
We're ready for the next question, John.
Yep, I'm trying to find the sheet. Give me a second. Oh, yes. Okay, here we go. N2A2H, Andy had a question about an amplifier, a kicker, that he's working on. Let me let it drop. Here's his question. He notices, and he has two of them, that he's experienced the same thing. Tubes are identical, and the amplifiers are identical. He notices as he's using it, and it seems to perform very well, that the output tubes, the plates are getting cherry red at the bottom, which is normal, but they're only red at the bottom. As it travels up, the plate gets darker to where it's completely black, and he wants to know, is that normal, or should the plate be sort of red all the way right to the top? What do you think, Dick? Back to you, KC2WGB.
Is this a kilowatt class afterburner, high power amplifier? Is the tube something like an 813 tube with a carbon plate, which at full power they do glow? What's your guess as to what kind of amplifier, what power, what frequency? Give me a couple of guesses there, John, go ahead.
Yes, Dick, it's about 500 to 1,000 watts, I would imagine. That's exactly what he's talking about, yes.
I would guess that if the tube was running normally, the filament slash cathode, in some cases it's only a directly heated filament because that puts your amplifier on the air in a hurry. You don't have to wait 30 seconds or a minute for the darn cathode to heat up. So in many cases, it's a directly heated filament. You would think that the filament would be reasonably equal in emission along the whole length of the filament, and therefore you would think you would get equal emission into the plate, and therefore equal plate current along the vertical dimension of the plate. Okay, now let's get realistic. Depending on how that filament is designed, the top of the filament is further away from the mass of the rest of the tube. Therefore, it's got more cooling capability. So the top of the filament might be running a little bit colder. The top of the filament is dissipating a little bit less current. So the top of the filament is putting less current into the plate compared to the bottom of the filament and the bottom of the plate. The plate itself has more exposure to the outside air, so to speak, on the top of the plate. There's very little stuff above the top of that anode. The bottom of that anode is looking into all of that structure that's supporting all the elements inside the tube, the rest of the tube base, and so on. So there's all kinds of jazz at the bottom, limiting the way the plate can dissipate heat. So there's a double thing going on here in my guess. Let me drop. So I think it's a combination of the top of the filament running cooler, less emission, and the top of the plate having greater capability of dumping the heat to the outside world. So for a dual reason I can think of, the top of the plate is going to be a little bit colder than the bottom of the plate. Therefore, the bottom will glow and the top will not glow. I haven't actually used that kind of a tube, and so I don't have a direct experience with that one, Joan. On the tubes that I've used that did have some glowing plates, 6L6 type tubes, center of the plate that glowed the greatest. Maybe you've seen something similar. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Yeah, Dick, that's most of the experience I have is the center of the plates, but I haven't worked on or watched that many amplifiers and worked on them, so I wasn't sure. But being that he has two of them and both of them behave the same, I think that maybe you're right that the lower portion where the mass is has better heat retention, so it's not getting the same cooling effect as through the chimney effect of the flow of the inside the tube itself. What's happening, that heat may be a lot less at the top of the plate. That's a good call, just the heat retention at the bottom. Yeah, that could be.
Yeah, there is no flow inside that anode of that tube. And by that, by flow, I mean the tube itself is a very high vacuum. So there's no material flowing in the empty spaces. And a hot object in a vacuum dissipates heat by what's called T to the fourth. In other words, the exact temperature raised to the fourth power indicates the rate of watts per square centimeter of heat radiation. And it really is radiation. In other words, it's a kind of a broadband transmitter. It's a noise broadband transmitter, a hot object that's glowing. And the reason why an object starts off as a dull red and then becomes a brighter red and eventually yellow and eventually white and eventually blue is the fact that, let me drop, I think it's called the Wien displacement law. If you actually plotted the energy output versus wavelength of an object at a particular temperature, what Mr. Wien discovered is that as you raise the temperature of something, it emits more energy at all wavelengths, but the wavelength that emits the maximum energy goes to shorter wavelengths at higher temperatures. Okay? Shorter wavelengths at higher temperatures really means you're shifting from what your eye sees, let me drop it, what your eye sees is red, orange, yellow, and then lighter and lighter yellow and eventually white. So your eye is looking at the maximum wavelength of the emission of that object as a function of its temperature. So it turns out that a skilled human being looking at the color of an object can make a pretty good guess as to what temperature that object is operating at. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Well, you're absolutely right there, because the old timers in the steel mill where I worked, they could look in that slate and they could tell if it was ready to tap that furnace just by looking. And meanwhile, quality control would come down with pyrometers and all this stuff, examining, and he would say, it's ready. Believe me, it's ready. And sure enough, he was right. So yeah, if you have the skill and you have that experience, you can definitely do it.
You will also see a significant difference in the amount of glow of the anode of a power amplifier depending on how you set the tuning and loading controls. If you set the loading too light, in other words, if it's a pi output network, and you set the C2 capacitor a little bit too meshed, too high in capacitance, you put out a little bit less power, the voltage in the anode goes higher, the current in the anode goes lower, and you stand a chance of arcing over the circuit. If you start opening up the C2 capacitor to lower and lower capacitance on an ordinary pi network, you're creating heavier and heavier loading. The heavy and heavy loading lowers the voltage on the anode. It's got less opportunity to arc over, but the anode is now drawing more current and creating more heat. This is on the assumption it's in resonance. If you've got the C1 capacitor of your pi network set too high or too low, so you're out of resonance, again, you'll be drawing lots of current and not putting out as much power. And of all the power you apply in volts and amps to the anode of your final tube, let me drop, you calculate the voltage and the current, and you may be putting in 1,000 watts of input power. And if the amplifier is running at 55% efficiency and it sets just right, 550 watts is coming out for the 1,000 watts you put in. The anode is therefore dissipating 450 watts. There are certain ways you can set the pi tuning and loading controls of that amplifier such that the ratio of power going in and power going out is a poorer ratio. Instead of it dissipating 450 watts, you can make it dissipate 550 watts, and you're going to get a brighter glow. So the brightness of that glow is also giving you some indication as to how heavy is the loading, whether or not it's in resonance. And if it was a tetrode-type tube, the amount of screen good current is also telling you a lot of information about whether or not it's in resonance and underloaded or overloaded. On many tetrode tubes, maximum efficiency and maximum power output occurs when the screen grid current is a very low number. And if the screen grid current is a high number, positive screen grid current, it tends to mean you're very, very heavy unloading. I got that right? Let's see now. Heavy unloading, small voltage swing. No. Heavy unloading, you'll start seeing very low screen current and even negative screen current. Very light loading, you'll start seeing a lot of positive screen current. So the screen current in the tetrode is a very sensitive testing for whether or not you're in resonance and at the right loading. A plate glow is another indicator, particularly on triodes.
Repeater, timeout.
As I said, particularly on triodes. Over to you, John. K2RIW.
Hey, really quickly, Anson.
KC2WGB, Hal recognized. You mentioned a very interesting thing, Dick, that some people forget, that PA load and PA tone. As you said, you put 1,000 watts into the tube. You have to realize that if you're 500 watts out, you've got 500 watts floating around going somewhere, and that's not good. Okay, back to you. Pick up, Hal.
Yeah, 99% of the power that's not coming out is being dissipated by the plate circuit of that tube. Over to you, Hal, K2RIW.
This is Zulu Alpha. If I use the amplifier, you don't know if the shunts are working properly for the plate current, the plate voltage, or grid current. So you may see all sorts of readings on those meters, but you don't see the right output power. You know that maybe the shunts or the accuracy of the meters are wrong. Go ahead, Zulu.
Yeah, as you travel, your signal's a little bit noisy, Hal, but that's a good point. Quite often, a person will take a 1 milliampere meter movement, put the right kind of a shunt across it so it becomes a half ampere or a 3/4 ampere or 1 ampere full scale meter. But that shunt, how good is the contact of the shunt today? Has it been abused? Is the current, is the shunt giving you the right number of ohms? So if the meter is reading correctly. So when in doubt, worry about whether or not your voltmeter and your current meter on your amplifier is accurate. And there's ways of testing that. So with your Bird wattmeter, you can see how much power is coming out and whether or not there's any standing wave ratio of the antenna, how much is coming back. And by way of the metering, in theory, if the metering is accurate, you know what voltage and what current you're applying. So therefore, you know the total energy input. Your Bird wattmeter is totally telling you the total energy output, and the ratio between the two is efficiency and or plate dissipation. And so when you're first setting up an amplifier, it's nice to check those things to make sure that the reason you bought that amplifier, the guy thinks it's running low efficiency. He might really have poor metering that's given him that erroneous conclusion. I bet you've seen that happen a few times, Hal. K6DBZ, K2RIW.
RIW K6DBZ, sure have. Also, you can't always trust the Bird. If you have a good RF probe like 410 B or C, go into a terminated 50 ohm load, bring the RF voltage, square it, divide it by 50, then you know your power is accurate.
Okay, you said you can't always trust the Bird. Well, for that matter, you can't always trust anything. My digital voltmeter, my volt-ohm milliammeter. Any instrumentation is capable of giving you error. But when it comes to the RF world, when it comes to reliability of test equipment, unless it has been heavily abused, a bird wattmeter is considered one of the more reliable things. In many cases, it's a purely passive meter, and as long as the guy is not throwing it on the floor periodically, they're fairly rugged. Yes, there are ways you can damage a slug, and when in doubt, plug in another slug to be sure that the reading you're seeing is reasonable. And if you happen to be using a load, let me drop it. If your load happens to be an antenna, and there's a defect in the antenna which is giving you a fairly high standing wave ratio, then the forward power and the reverse power are going to be interesting numbers. You might see 150 watts forward and 50 watts coming back. Now you'll ask yourself, what is the power the amplifier is really generating? It might not be generating 150 watts because that reflective power of 50 watts is coming back to your high output network in the final stage, which you've readjusted for that particular crazy load. It in turn is taking that 50 watts and re-reflecting it forward. So therefore, you could be using a 100 watt amplifier, an HW100 or some other kind of exciter rig that you know is good for 100 watts output. And with an antenna tuner and a defective antenna, you might see what looks like 150 watts forward. You have to be a little bit careful on how you judge that. Boy, we can get into discussions on that go on forever. K6DPZ, K2IZ, I bet you've seen confusion on that one, Hal.
One thing for sure, if you go into a 50 ohm semi load with a watt meter, you could see a 1-for-1. But if you go into a circuit and antenna, you may see a standing wave. The reason why you would see a standing wave is because you're looking for a reactive load. Curious coming out of the transmitter, you're not getting 1-for-1 match. Go ahead, Rick.
If the antenna on the far end of that transmission line, assuming it's a 50 ohm transmission line, if the antenna on that far end of that transmission line is anything but a pure 50.0 ohm resistor, if it's anything else, higher resistor or lower resistor, any resistor connected with a inductor or capacitor, if it's anything but a 50 ohm resistor, there will be a calculatable amount of reflected energy from that antenna. That reflected energy is measured by a phenomenon we call standing wave ratio. And so that standing wave ratio, you can call it a reactance if you like. It is a reactance at certain positions along that transmission line. You could call it a resistive mismatch. It can be all of the above. So if it's anything but a 50 ohm resistor, you're going to get a calculatable amount of reflected energy. The bird watt meter will tell you exactly what that amount of reflected energy is. If I had a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, and I'm putting 100 watts into that antenna, I will, by definition, get something like 9.5 watts of reflected power because of the 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. So the amount of reflected power versus forward power, go to a lookup chart if you want, or go to a calculation. It tells you what is the standing wave ratio, assuming the feed line is low in loss. If your feed line has a significant amount of loss, and you're making that measurement in the shack, you know that the real visuar at the top of the antenna, at the top of the feed line, at the antenna, is higher, because the transmission line insertion loss is giving you a loss of the signal that you deliver to the antenna. The mismatch antenna makes a calculatable amount of reflected energy, power, which then goes back down that same lossy line. Therefore, the ratio of forward to reverse power at the antenna is going to be a bigger ratio than the forward to reverse energy ratio you see in the shack. So if you do a calculation in the shack and you see what you think is a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, and you've got a couple of dB of feed line loss, there's a lookup chart and there's a calculation you can make where maybe the real visual of the antenna is 3-to-1. There's an amazing number of people who believe that a bird watt meter will never read accurately unless there's some exact number of wavelengths of transmission line. There's a ridiculous number of people who believe that. That story goes round and round and round on the 20-meter band every day. And so many people hear it so often, they believe it is the truth. Let me drop. There's a very respected individual at ARRL headquarters who had that belief because he had heard it so often. I got into a discussion with him in a set of emails back and forth on that exact subject. You read the manual on bird wattmeter, they do not tell you you need an exact number of wavelengths of transmission line in order for it to read correctly. A properly operating bird wattmeter, regardless of the conditions, as long as you're using the proper slug at that frequency region, whatever power it tells you is forward is real, whatever power it tells you is reverse is real, and the fact that the forward power is greater than the number that you know your amplifier can create, that also is real. And you can get into a big discussion on that one. There are people who say, yeah, you're reading 150 watts on a 100 watt exciter, that's only reactive power. I can put a directional coupler on that line, I can sample 10% of that 150 watts, and I can light a 15 watt light bulb with it. That's real. Not everybody's going to agree with that one. Might want to give a rebuttal on this one in Ohio. K6TPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
RIW in the TechNet, K3TPZ Mobile. I wanted to mention something else there. I can't stay up too long, but I just wanted to say a lot of people cannot afford high power dummy loads. Let's see, it works for them. An amplifier. Okay. An easy way to do it. Years ago, we used to use a light bulb. Tie it across a transmitter, see light, we knew we had a load. But that's not good today, because most of your solid-state radios like to see a match before they start pumping out the sauce. How do you do it? You go down to a hardware store, and get yourself a couple of light holders that hold bulbs, regular screw-in bulbs. You tie all these light holders in parallel, go to a coaxial cable, into a directional wattmeter, into a rig. Then, as the light bulb heats, its heat changes, its resistance changes. You key your amplifier, and you put the right number of light bulbs, the right watts light bulbs in, you're going to get a 1-to-1 when the bulbs are lit, and they can actually read your power. Or even on smaller solid-state radios, once you terminate the 50 ohm, you'll have your terminated 50 ohm peak.
Yeah, that is very crafty. 100 watt and 60 watt and 40 watt light bulbs, incandescent light bulbs, make very good RF dummy loads when used correctly. Takes a couple of tricks to do it, and Hal is giving you some of those tricks. You walk into Radio Shack, in the day when Radio Shack was there, Lafayette Electronics, in the days when Lafayette was there, and you ask for a 150 watt dummy load resistor at 50 ohms, and for the most part, the guy will say, what planet are you on? We don't stock this item. For you to build a 150 watt dummy load out of light bulbs is fairly easy. To buy a wire wound 50 ohm 150 watt resistor is very difficult.
And it has to be non-inductive.
Well, a wire wound resistor
is parallel light bulbs. Until you get the right light bulbs to have a 1-to-1 match when they're lit, you got a beautiful dummy load.
I accept that. And the wire wound resistor, because it's wire wound in a coil, definitely has some inductance. At, say, for instance, 80 meters, the total amount of inductance is fairly small. And there's ways you could put a metal piece of tubing over that resistor to cancel some of that inductance. And there's other ways you can tune out the inductance. So the total amount of inductance inside of a high-power wire-wound resistor is something you cannot ignore, but it's not huge. It's not a showstopper. There's ways around that for a crafty ham. But a much more pure resistor load is the incandescent light bulbs. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Ready for the next one, Joe.
Okay, Dick. Well, IRC and Milwaukee resistors, they make non-inductive wire-wound resistors. They're just wound in a very special way, and they work well, and they do make them up to 250 watts, no problem. them, like the 50 milligold shunts, or if they make up a shunt, they must remember that that shunt must be located as far from the heat source that they're measuring with, say, a tube or whatever current they're measuring. And also, you make your calibration of the shunt arrangement when the thing has reached its operating temperature, because many errors can happen that way. When you do it cold, you'll see a different reading on that meter than when the temperature gets to the normal position. So I just wanted to mention that, Dick.
I think you're saying that many of the methods of constructing a shunt resistor for a Dawson valve meter movement is made out of temperature-sensitive materials. That's sad, but I can see the problem. So what you're saying is that if that meter is rated for 1 ampere full scale, you're measuring that resistance cold. You may come up with the wrong number. Whereas if you really put 3/4 of an amp through that meter, the shunt resistor may have the right reading so that the meter reads correctly. Wow. That's a further complication to calibration procedures. Over to you, John.
Yeah, and in some cases where high energy, a lot of wattage is going by, a lot of heat, that can cause a little bit of a problem. Not often, but it's enough to change it a couple of percent. So if you're looking for real accuracy, move it from the heat source as far as you can, and then calibrate your structure after you've reached operating temperature, and that works well. I'll let it drop. I'll go on to the last question. Okay, I have a young gentleman here who's interested in ham radio. Not quite a ham, but he's getting ready. His uncle left him a stack of receivers, and two of them are what he calls TRF, and he'd like to know what that means, and there's quite a few knobs on the front that he's not familiar with, so maybe give him a quick rundown of what the TRF means. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yeah, there's a chance he's got a real good antique there. Back around, I'm going to pick a number, 1920, some of your major manufacturers like RCA, if they had already existed then, I'm not sure, Sylvania, RCA, Emerson, anyhow, the radio manufacturing companies in the beginning hadn't yet discovered superheterodyne. A superheterodyne receiver has usually an RF amplifier stage, a mixer stage, a local oscillator feeds the mixer, a signal gets heterodyne down to the first IF frequency. The majority of the gain of the receiver takes place in the IF amplifier assembly, and it goes to the detector, audio amplifier, and loudspeaker. That's a superheterodyne receiver in block diagram form. I think it was Mr. Armstrong who invented superheterodyne, and before he invented that, most radios were TRF. TRF stands for tuned radio frequency. If you wanted the radio to listen to a AM broadcast station at 1 megahertz, you had about 4 or so tubes in the radio, and you had 4 great big knobs on the front panel, and every one of those stages was tuned to 1 megahertz. So you had to track all of those knobs. So every one of the stages is tuned to 1 megahertz to listen to a 1 megahertz AM broadcast station. And after all those stages of gain, then there was the detector, the audio amplifier, and the loudspeaker, or the headphones. So before Superhet was invented, TRF was the way to do it. There's some huge disadvantages. The thing can easily break into oscillation. All the stages have to track. It's very difficult to get high selectivity at the RF frequency as opposed to the IF frequency. You can get beautiful selectivity because you're operating at a much lower frequency. And it's a lot easier to get gain at the lower frequency. Let me drop. So these TRF radios tended to be a rather large cabinet. I can remember the one that was at my grandfather's house that was 1.5 feet long, almost 1 foot deep, 1/2 foot high, oak cabinet with a great big cover on the top where you could open up the cover and look in there and look at the tubes. And look at these great big air variable capacitors that are connected to those 4 knobs on the front panel. The 4 great big tuning knobs. The small little knob off to one side was the volume control. But those 4 great big knobs were the tuning knobs for this TRF, tuned radio frequency radio. Nowadays, nobody would do it that way. But these things, if they were well preserved, they are definite antiques. And there are people out there who will pay big money to get one of those things in his possession, thinking about the good old days of the thing that he saw in front of his grandfather's house, at his grandfather's house. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I have a picture of one of them. It looks like an Atwater tent. Reverse cone speaker on top, and it looks like it's in pretty good shape. Or two knobs in the front and an off-on switch. I believe it's only battery operated. It has four tubes that I look like the old four-pin tubes, like something like that, tapped on the top. But interesting looking stuff. I'm sure you'll have a lot of fun if you get that hooked up to a battery. Might be able to do some listening. It's still usable. Should work. Okay, very good. I think it's time we go over the ball. That's it from the mailbag. And have fun.
John, on that whole last transmission, you were talking into the wrong mic again.
Because it's in front of me, you're absolutely right. But you copied what I said?
Yes, we did. You're Atwater Kent. The particular Atwater Kent that you knew of, what's your guess as to the year of manufacture? And what happened to that beautiful oak cabinet antique radio? Over to you, John.
The one Atwater Kent that I had was, I think it was 1929. Yeah, 29, if I remember correctly. And it was almost the size that you described. A beautiful cabinet and a nice finish on it. A little door on top, you could open it. You could service everything from the top. There were more inductors than capacitors in the Atwater Kent. Some of them had capacitors, some of them had those rotor inductors, but they worked very well.
Did you actually use that to listen to AM broadcast stations? And at the time you used it, would it tune the whole band, John? Go ahead.
Yes, Dick, and if I played with it, I could even rock it up into the aircraft frequencies. It would tune in from the aircraft frequencies and everything up to, I think, 1100 on the AM band. I don't think it went up to 16, but 11 was possible.
When you said the aircraft frequencies, okay, nowadays aircraft frequencies are roughly FAA 120 megahertz. I can't believe, what frequencies were the aircraft frequencies in those days, John? Go ahead.
I don't remember the AM frequencies at that time. I'm trying to think of how low that band went. I don't remember the numbers on the dial, but there was activity there. Now, I don't know if it was aircraft to ground or ground to ground, but it was definitely aircraft stuff that you could hear in there. Don't remember the frequency.
KC2QRQ. Go ahead, Glenn. What frequencies do you think were used for aircraft in the old days?
Actually, international aviation has always been around 5 megahertz, Dick. I'm not sure if it's still used or not anymore, but I think it still is. But I'm not really sure, but it was around 5 megahertz, KC2QIQ.
HY, I wanted to comment.
Yeah, Joe recognized. Let me go back to John first. John, do you believe your TRF radio would tune as high as 5 megacycles? Was the aircraft above the AM broadcast band? Or was it below the AM broadcast band? Over to you, John.
Well, I don't think it tuned much above 1100 on the AM band, but it could have been a multiple of frequency that was coming in. I'm not sure. I wasn't really into it that much. Aircraft was kind of boring at that time, but I know I heard aircraft frequencies. So, I don't think it was military. Joe has information on it.
In the case of a super heterodyne receiver, you have the ability, if the signal is strong enough, to listen to the image signal, the real signal, and harmonics of the local oscillator. So 2x1 and 3x2 and so on. In other words, second harmonic of the local oscillator mixing with the fundamental of the RF and so on. You can get various frequency combinations if the signal is strong enough, with super heterodyne. TRF has very little of that. You tune a TRF radio to 1.0 megacycle on all four of those stages, it's going to have an extremely poor response to any other frequency, if you know what I mean. It's got four track lacking Gaussian-shaped filters that essentially do not respond to harmonics, unless the great big large layout of the variable capacitor and inductor happens to have a auxiliary resonance somewhere else because of great big long wiring. Except for that phenomena, it's got very little spurious responses. Let's see what Joe's got to say on all of the above. W-H-U-L-Y-Y, where were those radar radio, here we go, where were those aircraft frequencies, Joe? W-H-U-L-Y-Y, K-2-L-A-W.
I can't tell you about all of them. One of my deputy know for sure, because I've listened to it from a pilot friend of mine. He told me the frequency. If you listen on 5598 USB, you can hear ground-to-air traffic back and forth. These are primarily for flights going over the Atlantic that are too far away out of VHF range. And I have seen a station that is used for this type of purposes north of West Hampton Air Base's airport, down around the West Hampton area, using horizontal antennas laid over a very large field type of area. Back to you.
In the case of the Voyager aircraft, done by the Rutan brothers, this airplane that flew around the world without refueling in roughly 1985, a number of people knew that they would be transmitting from the aircraft back to their base of operation at something like 8 megacycles, as I remember. There's a very exact frequency at 8 megs that was pretty well published, and lots of people listened to it. My buddy Kent, to B5BJB, was listening to the air-to-ground communications throughout much of that flight. So HF frequencies do give you some nice long-range communication back before the days when we had satellites and other techniques. So, I think you've come to the end of the mailbag. Is that true, John? KC2WGB, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Yes, Nick. Mailbag complete. Time to go over to Paul, see what interesting things he has for us this week. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Was there much activity tonight on Echo Link and chat room and whatever? Although I think a lot of people are recovering from all the snow shoveling they did today, so maybe our attendance tonight could have been kind of light. Over to you on that one, John.
Yeah, Dick, the chat room was really quiet. We had up to 8 people on Echo Link, but nobody signed in for anything. And now there's only 3. But, yeah, it's quiet evening.
The Echo Link people were located where? Was it New York State and Canada, for instance? Over to you, John.
Right now they're all local. We did have one Canadian station in there, and then one station I didn't see before. It was a WA call, but I don't know where that was from.
Okay. I got to periodically ask you, and future, remind me to ask you in the future TechNets to tell us where we're being listened to with Echo Link and IRLP. I think, can you also monitor IRLP, John? And I think in some cases the IRLP is covering foreign countries. Is that true?
Yes, I'm not able to monitor Echo Link yet. That I don't do. That might be possible, but I've got 3 monitors I'm running right now, and that's keeping me busy. But, yeah, that's a good idea. I'll let you know if anything from out of the neighborhood checks in, and this way you'll know what's up.
Very fine. So, what's going on in space, Paul? As you can tell, Lou thought that an article being written was giving an explanation for the wow signal on the Ohio radio telescope, and I'm a bit skeptical, as you can tell. It doesn't fit the right signature. Hopefully, the James Webb telescope is coming along nicely and it's going to be launched. And I'm sure we've had some other cargo launches either took place or in progress. And I'll bet you some of those entrepreneurs are fighting harder to get the first booster to come back down and land on its tail. It looks like that's going to be an exciting thing in the future. WS2N, space report number 184, I think it is. K2LAW TechNet, you got a pull.
Okay, Dick, yeah, 185 I'm showing. The wow signal. I remember in one of Carl Sagan's books, he discussed that, and he always thought maybe there's a possibility, you know, a couple of galaxies or, you know, some massive object, maybe even dark matter out there was creating a, you know, a lensing effect. And maybe that's why they only heard it once, and then it was, when they went back to it again, they couldn't repeat it. You know, that's the idea. If you do get any kind of a wow signal, the idea is to be able to repeat it the next day or something. They could never do it. Talking about the commercial people trying to bring their rockets back to Earth, just a couple of days ago, Blue Origin did it again. That's the company that's run by Jeff Bezos, founder of Amazon. And he has the New Shepard launch vehicle. And back just a couple of months ago, I think it was November, he successfully launched it to the common line, the 100-kilometer location, roughly 62 miles, I think 62 miles above the Earth. Considered space. Let me drop it. And he had successfully done that with his single engine attached to the New Shepard rocket. On top, they have a capsule, and it gets up there and separates from the booster. Capsule comes back on three parachutes, blue and red parachutes, and soft lands at 3 miles an hour on the ground in West Texas. Now, the booster, Charlie comes back down to the landing pad, close to the landing pad. They have it all laid out. And last time it came back right on the money. Now he took this booster back and cleaned everything up, made sure everything was working. All he had to do was change a couple of the things that he would normally change out, pyrotactics to separate the spacecraft from the rocket and a few other things, and he put it back on the launch pad 2 days ago and launched it, you know, to the same suborbital launch, and he got about a mile or two higher than last time, but same amount of fuel. He brought that craft back, and he intentionally changed the software on it to land there. He wants to get close to the point of, he's got a dot that he wants to land on Earth. And he changed the software that if it's coming down for that dot, you know, the previous software was saying it's got to land on that dot and that's it. And he's worried that that could cause a problem. Close enough was good enough, and if it came down when it was vertical, then it would, you know, continue down to the Earth. And
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Twice you did it with the same rocket. That's called the New Shepard. Originally, he tried it about 6-8 months ago, and the capsule came back successful, but the rocket had crashed. So, he got himself a new rocket, and he has now done this twice in the last 2 months. So he's doing pretty good. SpaceX is continuing on with their Dragonfly program. Dragonfly is the name that they gave us years ago. He had plans on eventually taking the Dragon itself again out in Texas and testing this capsule. His goal is to eventually bring this capsule back, propulsion only, all the way back to Earth. That's his long-term goal. But to do that, he needs to run a lot of tests in Texas. And the first did see the video on that. That was pretty neat. So you've got these 8 Super Draco rockets that are sticking, you know, that are built inside the, they're sticking inside the capsule, surrounding the capsule. So he's got, you know, like four packs of these things. And that was successful. So he's doing pretty good because he's able to bring his booster back as well. So we'll see what happens in the near future. I know he's got another launch coming up in about another month. The SES-9, that's a geosynchronous flight, commercial flight that he plans on putting up. And my guess is he's probably going to either try to bring that booster back to Cape Canaveral. It's a Cape Canaveral launch, not like the last one. The last one was from Vandenberg Air Force Base. That was almost successful. I think we talked about that last week. That was the one that came back down on a barge, and then one of the lakes in the lock-in, and it just tipped over and kind of exploded. He had plenty of fire protection equipment on board. In fact, when it comes down for a landing, you know, I can see these like 2.5-inch fire was going surrounding the barge. So, I mean, it put it out right away. So he's got most of his booster back, but it's kind of damaged. But at least he did it. He got it back on a barge. And, so he's got one successful landing at Cape Canaveral doing this. That was with the bigger full thrust rocket. This one that landed in the Pacific Ocean from Vandenberg Air Force Base. That was the older version of Falcon 1.1. Actually, it was an older version before that. You know, they started out with 9 rockets laid out like in a square grid on the bottom of the rocket. And then he went to the Octo version, you know, 8 of them surrounding one central one, and that would be the 1.1. Then he made the stretch version of that, and now he's got this full thrust version. He's not calling it one.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Cape Canaveral last month. Let me drop this. So then my two main topics that I was going to bring up, and then there's one that would probably save for the astronomy net. I didn't hear anything on it last time, so I'll bring it up here. They believe they've not located. They know pretty much where the new ninth planet would be. So they're looking for it now. They've done calculations using planets that are located in the Kuiper belt, and looking at the pattern, they believe that there's a big planet controlling the shape of these I call planets, but you know, small planetismals, I guess they would call them. But some of them are as big as Pluto. And this new planet is, their guess is probably about the size of Neptune. And way out there, though, you know, extremely elliptical and very big orbit. They probably think it probably takes maybe 15,000 years to make one revolution around the sun. But they're looking for it now. They got all sorts of telescopes, ground-based telescopes, looking for this thing. They're calling it Planet 9. Back to you, Dick. WSLI. I got more things, but, you know, there's... I could probably get 7 more topics I could cover. We're not going to do that. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, Pluto, I think, has a average distance from the sun of something like 39 astronomical units. And by the three-half law, we can calculate what that period is, and I think Pluto takes something like 250 years to make one revolution. If this newer Neptune-sized object out there in the Kuiper Belt takes 15,000 years, we can calculate how many astronomical units it would have to be to do that. And so by looking at the perturbation of other objects in the Kuiper Belt, once you locate them all accurately enough and track them accurately enough, let me drop it. You have the ability to say, okay, I'm seeing evidence of a mass concentration out there. How big would it have to be and how far away to fit this particular scenario to create all of these disturbances? So I think that is essentially the process by which Pluto was discovered, maybe Neptune, but the Pluto I think was discovered that way by looking at the disturbance in the orbit of the things they were tracking at the time. So that technique is tried and true, except this particular prediction is a much larger object at a much greater distance, and so they made the assumption, as I see it, that one single object is creating all of that disturbance that they've seen of the objects in the Kuiper Belt that they're tracking. Let me drop. There's also the possibility that life is not that simple. Not one single object in one single location. That Kuiper Belt can contain all kinds of objects. Kuiper Belt and Oort cloud beyond it. No matter what we think is the layout of this particular solar system, guarantee as we get smarter, we're going to find out it's a lot more complicated than we know about. So, to find an object that far away is going to be such a dim object, because the amount of sunlight getting out there is awfully small. That's not an easy find. So you're making the assumption it's one object, and you think you know the location, you tell everybody to look there and see if you see it. And they're looking for a dark piece of coal at nighttime. It's quite a challenge. I wonder if anyone has made a prediction as to what's the likelihood of discovering this object. WS2N, K2RIW, Great Pole.
Yeah, they've got a couple of telescopes, Earth telescopes, looking for it at the furthest distance. I think the furthest, I forgot the amount of AUs that it is, but, you know, it's elliptical. But if it's on the apogee part of its path, the Subaru, I think it's the Subaru telescope, and another one that have that capability of looking out that far to find a Neptune object. And then a lot of other telescopes could find it if it's in the perihelion location. But they know the area of space to look for, because they've got these small planets beyond Pluto. There's one called Sedna and a couple of the other ones. Some of them have numbers. I don't even think they have names yet. But they're large, and some of them are, like I said, the size of Pluto. But the way they're arranged in their orbits, they're elliptical, but they're all, the apogee of all these planets that are in the Kuiper Belt are all pushing out to one side, and the perihelion is well, you know, of course near the sun, but the way they sweep out, they're all sweeping out in one direction, and the only thing that could do that is, you know, control it to make that happen would be another, they looked at smaller planets, multiple planets, and the math guys, I guess, got together and realized that it would have to be a larger planet, and probably the size of Neptune. Let me drop it. So, therefore, they know where to look in the sky. You know, they're not going to look, 360 degrees or whatever it is. I guess that would be the wrong way to put it. What is it, 4,000 or 40,000 different degrees, something like that, on a three-dimensional sphere, and they don't have to look all